It's Ideasphere with Professors Greg Duncan and Richard Murnane, Restoring Opportunity.
Both Greg and I are economists, and we collaborated intensely on this project that led to this book as well as a prior edited volume. Our expertise is a little bit different in that we both know a lot about the economy and how it's changed and about income inequality and how that's affected children from low-income families, which is the focus of the volume.
The U.S. is losing its leadership position in high school and college graduation rates, and this in turn threatens upward mobility. Labor market changes over the past few decades have fueled increases in income equality, creating serious gaps, like those between the abilities of high and low-income families to nurture skills in their children. There's also a growing residential segregation and gaps between the skills and the schooling completed by children from low and high-income families. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, with Professors Greg Duncan and Richard Murnane. Their book, Restoring Opportunity, The Crisis of Inequity and the Challenge for American Education, offers a vision for increasing opportunity for children. First to join the show is Professor Duncan. Thanks so much for taking this time.
My pleasure.
There's a lot of material to cover here, and we'll be talking with co-author Professor Murnane as well. I'd like to begin with this fading opportunity for underprivileged kids. I don't think Americans are fully aware of the drastic effect this is having on our economy and the drag it is creating.
I don't either. You know, I think everyone knows by now that income inequality has increased quite a bit over the last 30 or 40 years. But what we've tried to do is think about and study the implications of increasing inequality for the next generation, for the workers who 30 or 40 years from now will either help to preserve the national prosperity or not, depending on the kind of skills that they come out with. And I think for us, the starting point is really what's behind the increase in income inequality. You know, over the 20th century, at the beginning of the century, inequality was very high. It fell drastically. And now it's climbed up again since the 1970s. And this time, it seems to be driven in substantial measure by computerization and globalization. So we've had what amounts to a hollowing out of the labor market, where skilled jobs, that semi-skilled jobs, too, that provided working-class incomes for someone with a high school degree have in large part disappeared. So for women, there used to be millions who worked in the back offices as secretaries of insurance companies and industries like that, and their jobs have simply been completely eliminated by computerization. Manufacturing jobs that used to enable someone with a high school degree, or maybe not even a high school degree, enable them to get middle-class incomes are no longer available because of globalization. So what's happened is at the same time income inequality has increased, these forces that are driving the incomes apart are also driving up, in the case of computerization, the needed skills to get decent jobs. So what used to be possible with a high school degree now takes at least a couple of years of college or 4 years of college. So we're upping the ante at the very time that the income trajectories of low-income families are going nowhere. So it's been this combination, kind of 1-2 punch, higher standards that we need to strive for combined with stagnating incomes for families at the bottom end of the income distribution that have led to big differences now, much bigger differences before, in the achievement levels of high-income kids versus low-income kids, in the college graduation rates of high-income kids versus low-income kids. The kind of increasing gap that you see in income levels has been accompanied by an increasing gap in test scores and an increasing gap in college graduation rates, which doesn't bode well for the future of the country.
This is an area that you have spent a good deal of time on. And just to give listeners a monetary perspective of what you're talking about, one of the charts in your book on page 29 shows the expenditures on children by income level. There is an 8 times gap between high income and low income.
That's right. And what's especially important is that gap has increased. So back in the early 1970s, when consumer expenditures were charted, if you divided families up into those in the top 20% and the bottom 20% of the income distribution, what you found, of course, high-income families were spending more, but they were spending $3,000+ per child per year on enrichment expenditures, things like child care and maybe private tuition, computers, things like that. $3,000 and some, compared to about $800 for families at the bottom. Fast forward to the 2005-2006, that $800 has gone up to $1,300 or so, but the $3,000 has gone up to $9,000. So you've had this much greater increase in expenditures on kids that amounts to $9,000 per kid per year for families in the top 20% of the income distribution. So the gap in terms of expenditures have increased along with the gap in income.
One of the projects that you have been involved with and write about, I had not heard of, and that is the New Hope program. This certainly shows promise. It's now 20 years in the making and has had excellent results, yet it really hasn't been duplicated throughout the nation.
Right. New Hope was born in the mid-1990s. It was a time when welfare reform was very much on the national agenda. And it was a program that was developed by a group of really community organizers in Milwaukee who worked with the business community to try to figure out a set of work supports that would be offered to low-income families, provided that the families committed to full-time work, that would enable the families to have an income above the poverty line, that the families would be able to afford decent quality child care, would be able to afford health insurance if families needed a temporary community service job to get the work experience so they could get a private sector job eventually. That was available too. So it was this package of benefits that was made available to families that could document working 30 hours a week or more that enabled families to balance the work and family demands in a much more feasible kind of way. I think everyone, middle class, upper middle class, knows the pressures of trying to balance work and family. And for low-income families who are down working at the minimum wage, it's a much harder problem. Things are much more precarious, and it's much easier for arrangements to break down and cause trouble with being able to get to work and so forth. So New Hope was intended to provide some margin of safety for families with these income supports, child care supports, and health care subsidies. It was run as an experiment, so some families were eligible for these benefits and some families weren't, and you were able to track those two sets of families for a number of years to try to see what sort of changes there were in the families. And as you might expect, the New Hope families worked more. But what was really interesting about the study was that we did interviews with the teachers of the kids in these families and asked about how the kids were doing in terms of their achievement, how the kids were doing in terms of their behavior. And one of the most striking results coming from this $3,000 or $4,000 package of benefits was that the kids, especially the boys, who were in the New Hope families, ended up with higher levels of achievement, much better levels of behavior. I think it convinced Dick Renane and me that if we were going to write a book that tried to lay out an agenda for helping low-income families with their kids attain higher levels of skills that they needed to succeed in the upcoming economy, it needed to be both school reform as well as some additional kind of family supports.
You give several examples of success coming out of New Hope, and one in particular was Miss Inez and what she had done in order to provide a better education for her children and part of the New Hope program. Something that strikes me, though, in the middle of this and seeing the successes and what you write about as well as some of those that were not nearly as successful, but the further the gap becomes between the haves and the have-nots is that the adult, B, being in the lower income gap and lacking an education is just going to generate the same thing, only worse, because the education drops a little bit more every generation.
Yeah, that didn't used to be the case. I mean, the whole American dream is one of ensuring that your kids are able to do better than you, getting more education, getting a better job. And for a lot of the 20th century, that was exactly what happened. Substantial numbers, majorities of sons were able to get more education than their parents, have higher earnings. And with respect to education, that started to turn. And you're now seeing declines in the fraction of boys who are getting more education than their fathers or girls who are getting more education than their mothers. It's really very depressing. It's a real clarion call, because what made the 20th century the American century was all of the progress that America made in its education system. The United States was the leader in universal primary education back in the 19th century. It was a leader in universal secondary education in the early part of the 20th century, and it built up a world-class higher education system, colleges and universities, over the course of the 20th century. So up until just 20 or so years ago, it's always been leading in terms of the amount of education that its kids got. But now the United States has fallen from first to 11th in terms of its college graduation rate, first to 19th in high school graduation rates. So we're losing our lead. And what our book, Restoring Opportunity, is trying to do is first diagnose the problem, why, and we're thinking that income inequality is playing a role. And then what can we do about it, both in terms of strengthening families, but especially strengthening schools?
And this is where the Common Core standards come into play, how vital that is. This is just the first building block.
Yes. Common Core is very controversial. And I think a lot of people have a misperception that the Common Core was invented by the Obama administration and is being forced down the throats of schools. That's just not the case. The Common Core began with a coalition of business leaders and state school superintendents who understood the nature of the challenge with skills escalating from computerization and realizing that American public education would profit from world-class standards in terms of learning goals for both literacy as well as math and science. There's also a set of science standards. What kinds of learning goals should kids have in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, all the way through 12th grade? And then how can we train teachers to teach according to these goals? How can we develop curricula that will move kids ahead? So we see the Common Core standards as a most promising development that will be very problematic at first, because those standards are considerably higher than a lot of school standards now. There'll be opposition, as there has been, from parents who are worried that their kids aren't scoring as high as they used to on tests. But you've got to sit back and say, what's going on here? What's going on here is that those Common Core standards were pretty much in line with the kind of standards that countries that are now doing better than we are in terms of education have for their education systems. So if we really want to maintain our competitiveness and produce skills in kids that are going to be necessary for the 21st century jobs, the Common Core standards, in our view, are a most welcome way of bringing that about.
This is an area that's easily overlooked, and that is the accountability. It appears that some folks are concerned about new ideas like Common Core because of the lack of accountability with some of the previous attempts.
Right. Accountability also has gotten a bad name, in part, I think, because of somewhat misguided ways that No Child Left Behind was implemented. Accountability became just kids scoring high enough on test scores to be judged proficient. And in Restoring Opportunity, we try to develop a different idea of accountability. We observed a very successful pre-K program, a very successful charter school program in Chicago, a very successful high school program in New York City. All three were serving low-income kids, and all three had evaluations that proved that they were effective. And what we observed as we went into these classrooms was elements of accountability that seemed to matter a lot for these teachers. The teachers felt accountable to each other for making sure that all kids learned. They felt accountable to parents for making sure that those parents' kids who were in their classrooms were learning. There were elements of having to meet test standards from the state, but they tended to welcome those because they wanted to provide education levels to their kids that would be up to snuff in terms of what the kids needed. So it was a more comprehensive sense of accountability that we saw in all these schools, and it seemed to be a very important part of what was motivating the teachers and the principals and the superintendents to make all this happen.
Well, Professor Duncan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I thank you so much for your time and effort on this. I think there's a value in so much you've incorporated into this work.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
I've been talking with Professor Greg Duncan. Next on the program is co-author Professor Richard Murnane, Restoring Opportunity, the Crisis of Inequity, and the Challenge for American Education. Check out their website that now features 6 new videos at restoringopportunity.com. This is Ideasphere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with co-author Professor Richard Murnane, the book Restoring Opportunity. Professor Murnane, would you mind giving us an overview to bring us up to speed on this?
Well, a theme of our book, Restoring Opportunity, is that the increase in family income inequality in the United States over the last several decades has reduced the quality of education available to children from low-income families, with quite disturbing implications for the nation's future, both for upward mobility of children from low-income families and for economic growth.
I ran across an article in the Los Angeles Times in reference to upward mobility, which is something that we've always considered vitally important to an education and, of course, for the American dream. But this article essentially establishes that nothing has really changed in the last 40 years, that upward mobility is still available and, in fact, has increased ever so slightly since 1970.
We're aware of that article. In fact, the lead author is a colleague of mine at Harvard, and we both read an earlier draft and collaborated in providing comments to the authors. They're excellent researchers, but I think it's important to put this in context. Effectively, what they are finding in their work is that there is just as much movement, for example, from being at the 20th percentile of income distribution in one generation to the 25th percentile in the next generation now as there was in the past. But what they do not examine, and they're very clear about this, is that the income differences associated with moving from one percentile to another are larger today than they were in the past. So the steps on the ladder are becoming further apart. And I think that's important because that means that families at the top of the income distribution, as a result of growing inequality, have much more money to spend on their children relative to families at the bottom than was the case several decades ago. And that's independent of having the same degree of intergenerational mobility as in the past. You're absolutely right that the idea of upward mobility has been at the core of American life for a very long time. I think in many respects it's the glue that holds our pluralistic democracy together. And it's important to recognize, and the authors of this new article agree, is that intergenerational mobility is lower in the U.S. than it is in the United Kingdom and in several European countries. So the idea that a great inequality is not a serious problem in the U.S. because we have much more intergenerational mobility than in other countries is simply not true.
Well, this is the aspect that you and your co-author here have written about. There are so many changes that have taken place, and I think the major one, besides the stagnant incomes of households, which leads to lower possibility for the student, but the technology gap that was predicted 20 years ago is coming true. Part of that is that the curriculum for your schools, some, cannot afford the technology to provide the education.
Well, I think there's no question that the economy in the United States has changed dramatically over the last several decades, and that's due to a significant extent because of advances in computerization and globalization. One consequence of that is that there are many fewer jobs today than there were several decades ago that pay living wage to do the same task over and over again, whether it be typing or filing or much of assembly line production work. And the reason is those are the easiest kinds of tasks to computerize and or send offshore to lower wage countries. So I think as a result of that, the skill demands for getting a good job are much higher than they were in the past. And the American educational system is attempting to respond to that by increasing the skills that it expects all schools to teach to all students, skills that several decades ago were only learned by a modest percentage of American children, and those primarily from upper-income families. Technology in the schools is an issue, but I think that's much less of a concern than the need to teach all children a quite demanding set of skills, much more demanding than the skills most children learned several decades ago. Learning how to do that as a nation is a central challenge.
Let's look at the situation that over the past 20 years we've heard in the mantra, throw more money at the education system. What you have discovered is that the end result is practically the same. It's not effective. You don't see it as necessarily, let's not throw money at it, but you and Duncan come at it from a completely different way. The money should be going in a different direction.
That's correct. And it's important to put this in context. It is not the case that American schools are less good than they were several decades ago. In fact, if you look particularly at historically disadvantaged groups, blacks and Hispanics, the test scores, as shown by the Assessment of Educational Progress, are somewhat higher today for those groups than they were several decades in the past. The problem is that while the test scores are higher, those children are not mastering these increasingly critical skills that are necessary to earn a decent living in this changing economy. Now, what has money got to do with that? Well, I think in the past, when schools had extra money, they tended to use them such as raising teachers' salaries or reducing class size or buying more technology. With exceptions, in general, these investments did not lead to fundamental changes in children's daily experiences in school. Unless there are fundamental changes in children's daily experiences in school, children are not going to learn different things and they're not going to learn more. So instead, what Greg and I have focused on is what does it take to really improve and change children's daily experiences in school? How do we make that happen in a consistent, constructive way? And then let's figure out how to pay for it.
And the other side of this coin, you're talking about teacher pay. It's also teacher education, or at least creative curriculum. Teachers are frequently using the same methods for teaching that were used 40 years ago.
That's correct. I think most teachers work hard. They try and do the best job they can. Like most of us, they act as adults the way they were treated as children. They have teachers whom they admired when they were young, and they typically follow those methods. This leads to quite teacher-centered instruction, and basically it helps children to learn to read well enough to comprehend and follow directions and do basic arithmetic. The difficulty is those skills, while sufficient to enable young people to get a middle-class job as adults 40 years ago, are not sufficient today. Today, for example, instead of being able to simply read well enough to follow directions, a definition of literacy today would require being able to search on the internet, and if you search on any topic, for example, global warming, you will get literally thousands of responses. How do you sort through those thousands of responses and decide which ones are accurate, which ones are potentially helpful in developing an understanding of the problem and what might be done about it? That's a very different and more demanding definition of literacy than was the case 30, 40 years ago. And to enable children to master these greater definition of literacy, these greater skills, requires a very different kind of instruction than most teachers were taught to use.
Where do we go from here? Something you point out in your work is that this is not going to happen overnight. We have to establish the steps and begin the work that's going to take possibly a couple of decades.
What we as a nation haven't figured out how to do is to provide to all schools, particularly high-poverty schools, systems that provide both the combination of consistent school supports and sensible accountability. You'd like to think school districts should do those two things, but it's very few urban school districts, if any, that are able to provide that critical combination. Now, we think there are some building blocks that provide a foundation for building systems that provide this combination. One element of the building block is this increasingly rich knowledge about how children and adolescents learn and how to improve teaching. We've just learned a lot about that. A second, these adoption of these Common Core state standards that we think provide clarity on what children need to learn, and that clarity is a first step in building good curricula and in improving training of teachers. And the third is there are an awful lot of organizations, most of the not-for-profit organizations, that were designed over the last 10 to 15 years to support low-income schools. Some of them train teachers, some of them train principals, some of them provide ancillary services. So finding ways to incorporate the energies and knowledge of these support organizations is a challenge, but I think that also can be a part of the solution. And of course, finding better ways to support low-income families, as was done in New Hope, is critical. So is high-quality pre-K programs, and so children start kindergarten ready to learn.
Professor Murnane, this has been most enlightening. Thanks so much for your time and expertise.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've been talking with Professors Greg Duncan and Richard Murnane, Restoring Opportunity, the Crisis of Inequity, and the Challenge for American Education. Check out their website at opportunity.com. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.